Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Visit wholefoodsmarket.com or download the Whole Foods Market app to learn more and find the store nearest to you.
I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. Last month, Hurricane Florence walloped parts of North Carolina. According to the Weather Channel, it was the wettest tropical storm to ever hit the Tar Heel State. So how did the restaurant industry respond? Some helped FEMA weather the storm, while others got to work feeding people on the ground.
We just walked in and said, we know how to cook, what can we do? They said, I need you guys to just cook 150 pork loins, and we were just like, okay.
Now the attention needs to be on Florence's long-term effect on North Carolina's farming community.
The general mood of farmers is one of certainly resilience and almost feels like it's the normal course of business to just get hit by a gigantic hurricane and need to just keep on going.
So tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to the Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. And on today's episode, what happens when food stylist Rebecca Pepler trades in her 250-square-foot New York City apartment for a room with a view in the 18th arrondissement of Paris? Well, for one, she learns about the power of apéro. Aperitif, cocktail hour the French way, is as much a cookbook as it is a guide through the fundamental nature of pre-dinner drinks and the utmost importance of taking time for yourself and others while savoring said sip. With recipes for all seasons and savory bites to pair, Aperitif gives you time to enjoy your joie de vivre in a glass. How was that pronunciation?
It was pretty good.
Pretty good. That's like a 7.
Yes, you're very good.
Thank you.
You speak French very well.
I appreciate it. As you tell me that in English. Yes. We've known each other for a long time, so no introductions are necessary. Plus, you can listen to a past episode, which you've been on, and talked all about your food styling life. But this is another chapter. This is another iteration of who you are. And I've even noticed on your website that you've dually listed yourself as a stylist and writer. Mm-hmm. That said, you certainly are one because you have a book that just came out today.
I do.
And how wild is that?
It's wild. You saw me right before coming in here. It's feeling real wild at the moment.
Yeah.
But in a very positive way.
And though this book pertains to this Francophile, or now that you live in Paris, French way of enjoying a drink before dinner, did you have that same sensibility about what to snack and drink on before a meal when you grew up in Wisconsin? Like, what is the Wisconsin apéro / apéro snack?
Oh, man. Cheese curds and beer?
It is.
Or an old-fashioned, I guess, if you want to go cocktail instead of beer. But, that's it. Or a Shirley Temple, if we're talking about when I was living in Wisconsin.
I do see a lot of grenadine in this book, and I felt like maybe that parlayed into your later life.
Definitely.
But again, this transition from being a food stylist to writer, and certainly not losing the food stylist part of your life, this was a big transition.
Yeah, a coming home, kind of, also. I think a re-transition back into what I had originally started out as. I went to school for journalism, always knew I wanted to write, and then I fell, as so many of us do, into a career that was adjacent to what I wanted to do and not exactly the thing, which I love. Food styling is amazing, and I've had such incredible luck in that side of my career. And it prepared me to write this book, to be perfectly honest. We actually, when we met, I was making cocktails at my former job and needed help learning how to shoot them. So it really comes full circle, even with us.
And the perspective didn't change that much either, because you once had a Brooklyn rooftop and now you have this amazing skyline of the Eiffel Tower. But I feel like the biggest transition, at least for knowing you so well, was that this is yes, a book about a very specific thing, mm-hmm. but I feel like the book came out of a situation in where you had to embrace apéro. You had to embrace the apéritif and taking that time for yourself and reflect on where you were and what you've done, mm-hmm. and then that became a book.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I started drinking on a rooftop in Brooklyn long before I knew I was going to move to Paris or knew what apéritif was in the first place. It was born out of being in my 20s and not having the funds to go out drinking every night, but wanting to kind of surround myself with good friends and good food and good drink. And so I started kind of self-teaching about different types of bottles to put on my bar cart, and inviting people over. And then when I moved to France, I was introduced to this lifestyle that I realized that I had kind of like fallen into, but fully embraced once I got there, for sure.
What happens during apéro hour? Is it like happy hour here in the States where it actually lasts 3 hours and you try to get as schnookered as quickly as possible?
Schnookered.
Yeah, I'm saving that for you.
No. So there's a modicum of similarity overlap between happy hour and apéritif hour. But it really just lies in the time of day. So it's after work, before dinner. The rest is different between the two. So happy hour, you're right. You want to get schnookered. You want to get 2-for-1 drinks and kind of forget your work day. And with apéritif hour, it's more have something lovely, usually lighter, low alcohol by content, low alcohol, gosh, words, low ABV, alcohol by volume, and transition from your end of your workday into your evening. It opens the night rather than ends the day, if you think about it like that. And it can last, yeah, like, you know, a few hours after work. It can last all the way into the evening and make it into a kind of apéro dînatoire. Or it can just be like 45 minutes, meet up with a friend, have a drink outside at a cafe, and then move on with the rest of your night. It's lovely. It's got a lot of different iterations.
I've been able to actually experience this with you in Paris, which is a wonderful thing. And I wonder whether or not it is actually a pre-dinner only thing, or it is a lifestyle that lives outside of that context.
Fully. Yes, it can enter you into your dinner portion of the evening. But yeah, it's a moment. It's a magical moment in time that is taken throughout the entire country. You know, it's not Paris-based. And I was really specific about that when I was writing the book. I didn't shoot it all in Paris. I didn't write about it only from Paris. When I was researching, I traveled all over France. And yeah, it's a moment that you take with your family, with your friends, with yourself, just to like take a breath, take a pause, and then move on with the rest of your day.
I mean, yes, there are low ABV, fortified wines, liqueurs, and, you know, like shandies of cocktails, but the regionality of the spirits is what was kind of so fascinating to me. Mm-hmm. And it's in a lot of these boxes on these specific pages that you tell a little bit about these trips you've, you know, ventured on to a couple of these, you know, spirit makers. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about what those trips were like, what you retained from, you know, those places, but also the beauty.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Because they seem like stunning sights to visit.
It was amazing. I mean, France is beautiful, and I feel very lucky that I got to travel so much of it while I was researching the book and call it work rather than just holidays. Although it felt, you know, drinking and traveling usually tends to like lean towards a holiday feel. I did a bunch of different trips. One, the biggest one was a 10-day solo road trip from Marseille all the way down to the border between Spain and France. And I stopped all along the way I had pastis outside of Marseille. I had beer and sous at the facilities further south. I was able to drink vermouth at Noli Prat and talk to the people that are producing it right now, because, you know, these apéritifs, these bottles of apéritif are rooted in such history, but they're still modern things that are created every day, every year in France. So it was really nice to have that juxtaposition of being in the spot that they were created and still being created in sometimes very similar ways to the way that they first started, and in other times very modern ways, but still retaining that sense of place and history.
When did it change that seeing these spirits on people's bar carts didn't mean that they were gifted it from a friend and it mm-hmm. became a dusty bottle that just sat there as you know, a memory of you know, said friendship. Mm-hmm. And it turned into an active friendship by sharing it with friends.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's always had a place with friends just as much as family. However, you know, as you I think you had Lindsay on your podcast as well, the writer of The New Paris, Lindsay Tremita. She talks a lot about that transition into what The New Paris specifically, but kind of the modern France looks like. And I think there was a transition when cocktail bars started opening up in the bigger cities across France. And these old apéritifs started to be brought back. Like one of the recipes in the book is by a gentleman who owns Le Syndicat, which is a beautiful cocktail bar in Paris. You should all go if you're visiting the city. But his focus is on taking all of these old, you know, quote unquote old apéritifs and bringing them into the modern age by using them in more modern formats, which is, you know, pretty much what I tried to do with the book as well. So it was really nice to have his cocktail in here.
Yeah, I mean, you have to modernize certain things like Dubonnet. Mm-hmm. I forget what the story was, but mm-hmm. it was given to some legion or somebody during a war, and it was mm-hmm. trying to get somebody to drink that. You can better explain it, or there's a box in the book that does that, but taking these spirits outside of history and modernizing them is such a non-French thing.
Yeah. That's true. You know, Dubonnet is funny because it is still, I think, you've kind of singled out one of the apéritifs that's still thought of as an old apéritif in a dusty bottle on a bar cart. But it has such a rich history and a place on your modern bar cart, and that's what I was really interested in looking at when I started writing recipes with it. And that goes for everything. Sous is another one that, you know, when I first started writing the book, I was talking to a French friend, and she was like, I always thought of Sous as like my grandpa's drink. Like, that's what young person would ever drink Sous? And now we're seeing it, you know, not just within the context of apéritif, but at all these cocktail bars, like when you order a white Negroni, that's Sous instead of Campari in there.
Campari. Italian.
What a great transition. Yeah.
But I mean, Campari is Italian. You have Aperol in there, even Sherry, which is from the south of Spain. Apéro isn't specifically French as far as what spirits are in the drinks.
Not specifically. It's largely, and I wanted to keep it as much as I could within the boundaries of the country, if you will. However, Europe is small, and it bleeds. All the cultures bleed into each other a little bit, and the neighboring Italy and Spain definitely come into play in French apéritif and vice versa. And so when I was writing the book, I kind of looked at what people were drinking now and what matters, and you know, Campari and Aperol come into play. Spritz culture has, I mean, started to take over the world a little bit. And I think that I have plenty to say on that side of things. But I think that it, you know, in any apéritif that I'm seeing happening in Paris, you're seeing Campari on the list. And, you know, sherry is something that people think about as an older spirit as well, right? And it's just so interesting and nuanced, and it's such a great way to build flavor in a cocktail without having to add all these hard spirits, because in the book, as I'm sure you noticed, there's no hard alcohol whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's all fortified and low mm-hmm. ABV, and I think mm-hmm. it is such a great introduction, because if you were ever in high school and tried to slug some of these bottles because that was the only thing that was available on your parents' bar cart, because I never did anything like that.
Never.
Really, really intense to imbibe a lot of it, but to have a little sip, like you said, it's so nuanced, and there's such, you know, there's infinite depth in it.
Definitely. You can drink it alone. You can drink it with a cube of ice. A little twist of citrus helps bring something out. And then adding it into cocktails, just the cocktails in the book are just so simple. I think 5 ingredients at most for all of them. And you're able to build such complex cocktails with small amount of ingredients because they are so nuanced and interesting. And I think that's something that's really special about apéritifs.
And there's not to say that there isn't champagne, beer, and wine involved in all these things as well. No. On that, we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back and talk more apéritif with Rebecca Pepler. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market. From papayas and samosas to reishi mushrooms, if it's something that sounds delicious, chances are you'll find the freshest, best version of it at Whole Foods Market. They have more than 400 stores across the country, so if you consider pizza its own food group or just can't imagine when avocado toast wasn't a thing, Whole Foods Market has you covered. Visit WholeFoodsMarket.com to find a store near you. Whole Foods Market. Whatever makes you whole.
Hey, and welcome back to the Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkill. Here today, almost at Apero Hour with Rebecca Pepler. I mean, what really defines pre-dinner? I mean, breakfast and lunch are both pre-dinner.
Whatever's in your heart, Michael. Yes. you go with your gut on that one.
Yeah, in my heart is actually a decent amount of Lillet if I had my choice. That is my like go-to fortified wine. And when Lillet Rosé comes out, holy crap.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is my lifeblood. It is. It really is. But on that, let's get into the book, Cocktail Hour, The French Way. Mm-hmm. And in France, it has seasons. It's not, you know, Santa Monica. There is warm, hot, cold, cool, and you've broken the book up to be able to drink in any season. So thank you for that.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you for liking it.
Yeah. And let's start with warm, because we are transitioning in New York into that wonderful autumnal weather, and it makes me want to drink. I mean, I love drinking year-round, but there's something about, like, having a hot toddy or having, like, some kind of, which one is it, shot or foie?
Vin chaud?
Chaud. It was neither. yeah, but having, like, a warm cocktail just to warm your spirit is a thing of beauty.
It's once the weather starts dropping, you want to warm yourself from the inside out, right?
So what is your warming drink of choice?
Warming drink of choice. You know, there's two warm mulled wines in the cocktail, or in the book. A vin chaud and there's a rouge and a blanc. And I really like the white wine, the mulled white wine. It's great. It was, when I tested it, I wasn't sure which way it was going to go, and it went really well. However, there's also a mulled rosé, which I made into a shot, and highly, highly recommend taking it, because you take it warm. And it's the first time in my life I've had a warm shot, and I will be doing it every single year when the weather turns.
I also like how the red version is built for a crowd, too. So rather than making these, you know, slightly bespoke cocktails per person, you're serving this thing, you know, fruity red wine, honey, black peppercorn, star anise, a whole bunch of lime juice, and letting people kind of take it at their will.
Yeah, the lime juice is such a fun addition because, you know, mulled wine can get really fruity and intense, right, and spicy, and the addition of lime juice right at the end cuts through all of that and it makes it into a more complex cocktail than what you're, you know, expecting.
Actually, one of my favorite forms of acidity, and this is going to surprise you, is verjus. And you have
mine too. Yeah.
And you have two drinks, a Miss Scarlet and a verjus, great name by the way.
Thank you.
With both using verjus, one white, one red, and you know, first explain what verjus is. I think of it as like pre-wine.
Yeah, well, it's it translates to green juice in French, right? And it's basically made from unripened, unfermented wine grapes. And it's just like, it's that bright, crisp acidity that you want from citrus, but without the lime flavor. Orange flavor, lemon flavor. Like, you're just getting the acidity without having to, like, add in one of those flavors into your cocktail. So you can build a base off of that and go any way you want. Those two are two of my favorite recipes. I mean, the Miss Scarlet, anytime I can talk about Clue. I never thought that when I was writing a cookbook I'd be able to slip it in. But, like, I had a huge crush on Miss Scarlet when I was watching that movie multiple times as a child and every year still as an adult. And it's nice to have a little homage to her and also include one of my favorite ways to acidify a drink, if you will.
acidity in other ways, or those citrus notes, when it's warmer out, come via peels and the citrus oils that are in there, as well as a lot of the liqueurs that have a little bit of like citrus rind to them. They're not quite as bitter as Campari's and have a little bit more aroma and effervescence. What do you think is the bottle that will be the gateway into all the rest in the book?
Oh, Lillet, for sure. For sure. I mean, the best thing about Lillet, and I know that it's already in your heart slash liver, so I don't have to sell you on it.
No, like literally it is in my heart.
Coursing through your veins. Went down the wrong pipe. No, the best thing about Lillet, besides the fact that it's just delicious on its own, is that there are three types. And so it's a great addition to your bar cart, but it doesn't have to be just one bottle. You have white, blanc, red, rouge, and rosé, Lillet. And so you get like a 3-for-1 kind of deal, and you can make a ton of, like, all the recipes in the book that utilize Lillet specify which one to use for them, but a lot of them can be switched out, and that just changes the flavor slightly of the drink and gives you a little choose-your-own-adventure experience.
There are so many drinks in here that I just want to drink right now, and I don't know why we aren't. Oh, well, they don't know. We're drinking them.
Totally. I'm not drinking water at the moment.
Every single drink we mention, we're taking a sip of at the moment. Or I wish I actually had a Cure beer with me. I was a huge Shandy fan when I lived in Boston. You could walk around with a styrofoam cup full of beer and orange juice. And it was terrible beer and terrible orange juice. But then I saw things that exemplified what that drink was and exalted into a place that it should be.
Well, thank you. Yeah, we have a lowbrow brilliant mimosa in there, which I think you're referring to. And I do say, like, you know, use fresh orange juice, because I just don't know why anyone would buy boxed orange juice. There's oranges that you can squeeze, and it tastes so much better. And in France, we're so lucky because you can walk into pretty much any convenience store and get fresh squeezed orange juice. But then use cheap beer, like whatever cheap beer you love. So you're getting a little lowbrow and a little brilliant all together.
I also love the Monaco, which you say in the book was or is a drink for French high schoolers.
Right? They're so much chicer than we were. Just so much chicer.
But it's kind of like a Shirley Temple meets a Shandy.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. It's sweet. It's bitter. You use a darker beer for it, so it has a little bit of a body, and it kind of has, I don't know, a milkshake root beer float kind of feel to it with just a little bit of alcohol.
And then the Cure beer with creme de cassis and a little chilled lager.
I mean, creme de cassis is, if you want one thing that's going to make your bar cart feel French, just like throw that on there and throw it in anything. It's amazing. And you don't have to use a ton of it, so the bottle will last you a long time.
Is there a cider scene going on in Paris right now, or at least in the Paro hour?
Yeah, so one of the trips I did was to drink a bunch of cider, and there's some really great artisanal producers that are doing cool things in France right now. And some of the cocktails in the book use cider, and I think that it's so interesting because cider alone is great, and it can be really complex and flavorful, but when you add it into a cocktail or an aperitif, it adds effervescence without having to add champagne. It adds, you know, these apple-y flavors without having to add Calvados, etc. And it just, like, it's a one-hit wonder.
I mean, there's the Cidre, the cider with fresh apple juice, the Pomode Normandie.
Yes.
Which, if I haven't been to Normandy, but I'm dying to go, just drink cider, eat crepes, and stay forever.
Yes, Normandy is it's a special place. Normandy and Brittany both. Some of my favorite memories are there, for sure.
I mean, it's a lot of drinking that you did for this book. A lot of drinking. And thankfully, you are masterful at the bite that goes along with it. You are a great snacker, aside from just your, you know, your cheese curd affliction.
Thank you for complimenting my snacking skills. I appreciate that.
But in there, you have garlic herb, pommiers, tapenade batons, potato chips, of course, salt and vinegar popcorn. Were these traditional snacks that happen at the bars, or were these out of your own, you know, your
snacking
own
wants? Yeah, it's a mix of everything. So with an aperitif, you always have a snack in France. There's always a little bite that goes alongside of it. It keeps you drinking. It gets you excited for your dinner. It's what aperitif is. It's not just a cocktail. It's always with a snack. So at bars, you get like peanuts, popcorn, etc., a bag of chips, bring it by the canal. But I wanted to expand a little bit on it and make it, you know, recipes that are snack recipes. So some of them are traditional, like tapenade, pisseladière. Other ones are a little bit more quirky, like the popcorns are not your traditional flavors. And I wanted to add a little bit of my own experience aperitifing with friends into that. So I make a little bit more complex snacks. I don't always just open a bag of potato chips.
I mean, there are rillettes of the salmon mm-hmm. variety, pâté, that are made of mushrooms and, mm-hmm. and certainly gougères. But I did see that caramelized onion and creme fraiche dip, and I felt like you're just making cheese dip.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Actually, that one's a really fun one. When I was doing that road trip in the South, I stopped. A friend was shooting her book, and they had just wrapped the photo shoot, and I came in, you know, at the perfect time because there were leftovers, but everyone was done working and had started drinking aperitifs. And she was like, look, can you just go in the fridge and utilize whatever's in there and, like, make something? And there was creme fraiche. There was harissa. There were already caramelized onions, which, like, God bless that. And I threw them all together with lemon juice, and we ate it with potato chips, actually. And I knew immediately that was the first recipe that I wrote for the book, because it was easy, smart, and honestly, I didn't have to do any work in writing it.
Well, and I love how they're communal in the same fashion that I feel like this hour or multi-hour portion of the day of drinking is as well. Like Le Grand Aioli. Mm. You know, it may just be seen as crudités and aioli, but it's so much more than that, because it brings a whole bunch of people around a table, you know, sharing this centerpiece.
Mm-hmm. Yep, definitely. And aioli, if you don't know what it is, it's mayonnaise. And who doesn't want to dip vegetables in mayonnaise and call it a snack? But yes, it's very communal. It's very... open for interpretation. So in that recipe in particular, I have the recipe for the aioli, but then it's, you know, whatever vegetables are in season, whatever you like, whatever you don't like take off. You know, some people don't like fennel the way that I like fennel. So don't include it if you don't want it.
Being one of the finest milkmaids, I mean, cheese purveyors that I know, I couldn't go without mentioning a whole baked Mount d'Or. And I saw that thing, and it's actually the first thing that I wrote down. Ask Pepler about that whole baked Mount d'Or. And I wonder whether or not, or how you paired certain drinks with certain foods, or what begat what.
Oh gosh, the Mount d'Or. It's such a short season in France for that particular cheese, and it's such a special thing. I tried to make most of the recipes really accessible and easy to make any time of the year, and that's one of the few that's, you know, you have to get it in season, otherwise it's just not as good. But with that, you know, when we shot the book, we shot that particular photo in Normandy, and it was cold, and there was a fireplace going on, and my team was there. The photographer Joanne Pye was, you know, shooting it and then digging into it immediately after. And that was a really communal experience. And there were definitely the cocktails we were shooting, but I think Dubonnet goes really well with that, speaking of, as we just discussed.
Yeah.
Dubonnet with a little champagne. Just, it cuts through that wonderful, cheesy, fatty dish and makes it something really special.
You've lived and or live in Brooklyn, in L.A., in Paris. You're not asking people necessarily just to make the drinks in the book. You're asking them to go out and experience this. And you give such a great compendium of places to do so. What are some of your favorite places to drink around the world right now?
Oh, man. Well, yeah. So I give a list of the cities that are kind of what I think of as my cities. So Brooklyn, Paris, and L.A., there are plenty of other places in the world to drink, but those are the places that I drink most often and know well enough. Here in New York, Four Horsemen, I was actually there last night drinking aperitif with a friend. That's one of my favorite spots. And then also June Wine Bar, which I'm going to tonight, is also just, I mean, it's hard to top. And I live in Paris, so that's saying something. In L.A., Cafe Stella is this like tiny little wine bar in the back of a larger restaurant. And the team there is just doing such an amazing job at bringing Paris to LA that it's usually my first and last stop. Even if I'm coming from and going back to France, I'm like, I'm there having Apéro during their Apéro hour, which is great because not a lot of people are doing like, they're doing happy hour, but not Apéro hour. And they're really embracing the French lifestyle in the whole way.
Thank you for bringing aperitif to the States, if not the world. You know, I couldn't be prouder of this being bookended, published out there in the world, and to see where it goes and how many more Apéro hours come out of, you know, you doing the hard and diligent work of drinking all those cocktails. Yes, Thank you for being a trooper, Pepler.
Thank you, Michael.
You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan-Turkel. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. A big thank you to our sponsor, Whole Foods, Music by Cookies, and Matt Patterson Engineering. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.